Okay, welcome back. Mitchell Henderson is back with us tonight. Hello, Mitch. How was your weekend?
Hello.
Okay.
Good. Yep.
Good. So we're on the edge watching this whole thing, this charade, this Trump charade of changing direction, and we're going to stop that war in Ukraine. No, they're not. And no, he's not going to withhold one penny as requested by the Zionist State of Israel. We're going to continue participating. And in fact, well, we are allowing, if not actually providing for the reality of this genocide. We're making it happen. It's us. It's the U.S. Israeli genocide of Palestinian people. It's not going to change. This is, I've been saying, I'll say it again. You've heard the old expression, Zionist occupied government, otherwise known as ZOG, ZOG. Well, I've changed it. It's Zionist-owned government now. That's my take. Anyhow.
Well, they're all Zionists up there. I mean, what has changed? What is changing with Trump is that you know, it's a tactical change. Okay, we have blown money, we have blown ammunition, we've blown missiles, air defenses in Ukraine.
Disarmed ourselves. Yes.
Okay, and what they want to do, the focus of the Trump administration will be to defeat Iran. But they need guns, they need money, they need to change our military so that it is a military, because it's not now, it's a bunch of sissies.
That's not going to happen, as you know. It's not going to happen. We're not going to defeat Iran. Russia won't allow it.
Well,
China and India are backing Iran, too.
We think that we're going to do this because we live in this Zionist vacuum. Remember,
I
once before said that what we live in, the world that we live in, the world, and the world they tried to sell you on, is the Jewish constructed consensus reality. Okay,
right.
And look, so many people still are there. Okay, people are waking up. People are starting to understand that it's not America first. Even with Trump, it's not America first. It's Israel first. We have to die for Israel. We still have to die for somebody
else.
You got
it. Okay. You got it.
So yep. It's like I saw Mike Waltz on Fox News, and Mike Waltz was he had met with Jake Sullivan just to show you. This is an example of the Jewish constructed consensus reality. So he said that him and Sullivan were a team. Okay, I beg to differ.
I couldn't believe that,
Mike Waltz. We voted for Trump. We voted for Trump. We did not vote for Biden. We are not a team. Biden is the enemy. Okay, so we did not vote for that shit. That's the first thing, Mike Waltz. Wake up. Nobody voted for Jake Sullivan and Jake Sullivan's worldview. Nobody
he is our national security advisor right now under
he
Biden.
He is a very mediocre, lying piece of shit, is what Jake
that's
Sullivan
correct.
Is.
Yeah,
and what Mike Waltz did is he got up and he said the exact same thing that you hear, the exact same lies that you hear coming out of Jake Sullivan's mouth every time he gets on the news. Okay,
yes,
the
sir.
Same lies, not a shade of distance. And what Mike Waltz said is, Well, we're not going to allow anybody to take advantage of us during this transition. Who's taking advantage of the United States? Who's taking advantage of the transition? It is Joe Biden that sent missiles deep into Russia when Putin warned against doing that. And in fact, you know, I mean, still Sabrina Singh gets up there and says, oh, we're not at war with Russia. Well, I beg to differ. Russia has a different view now. As of now, the United States, Great Britain, and France are at war with Russia, and Russia knows it.
You got it.
So this is the crap that we're putting up with. All right, it's just gonna keep going and keep going. I mean, you know, they don't want you to have any peace during this Thanksgiving, Christmas holiday. They want to threaten you make you feel insecure.
Chaos, stress,
and keep
fear.
Keep you off balance.
What they want.
Yeah, exactly. Anything they can do that, okay, they will do. You know, I see, you know, when you look on Fox News and you see General Jack Kane or there's a whole slew of people that get on there and talk, our national security experts like Jack King. These people are lying sacks of shit. They know what the truth is, and they're sitting there telling you the military-industrial complex line. Okay? They're shameless, is what they are. Shameless.
Simon Gorka?
You know?
Sebastian Gorka, rather. I keep saying that.
Yeah.
Sebastian Gorka is another one. He's a media phony, and Trump just appointed him to be his top director of counterterrorism in the world. This guy's gotten a major plum. This is a huge responsibility. And if you were listening,
you know, the truth is he has an easy job. Trump gave him an easy job because the United States of America controls terrorism in the world. Okay, we're the boss of terrorism. Terrorism doesn't happen unless we say it does. Okay, we control ISIS, and ISIS is the only terrorist organization out there right now that does anything, and they do what we ask them to do. They work for us. Okay, so Gorka's got nothing to do because he's in charge of terrorism. He's not fighting it. Okay, so at any rate, I wanted to talk tonight more on the principles of war because you have to understand these. To fight. So let me just go back and reiterate a few things, okay? So World War One was a war much like this Ukraine war. It was just wholesale slaughter in the trenches on the front line. I would say World War One was worse than what's going on now, okay? Because they didn't have medicine, they didn't have a lot of things that they have now. It's a little bit more comfortable than it was
back
then, okay?
That's correct.
It was just a slaughter.
No medevac, okay? No, nothing.
Right.
No.
So two British officers, Captain J.F.C. Fuller and Captain B.H. Liddell Hart, they went through all the wars in history, and they started looking at what makes you win, what makes you lose, and they established these principles of war. Now, the principles of war doesn't matter what your technology is. These principles apply whether you're using spears or nuclear weapons. These principles apply in a fistfight between you and another individual person, and they apply up to thermonuclear war. So they apply across the board, okay? So what happened is they developed these, and the only army that took them to heart was the German Wehrmacht, okay? The Heinz Guderian actually put them into practice because it was J.F.C. Fuller and Liddell Hart that came up with the concept of Blitzkrieg. But the British Army, you know, they're kind of class people. The upper class are like, we're not going to put up with this, you know. But the Heinz Guderian, he listened, he paid attention, and he started implementing it, and it worked very well. And the Germans used the principles of war. Okay, so then later we did up until Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton decided, oh, these principles of war, you know, it's too violent and stuff. You know, we can't be teaching our soldiers this stuff. You know, so he kind of took it out. He made people quit learning it. You know, let's not teach our military how to fight. You know, based on proven historical principles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that's what these principles are. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to continue where I left off, but what I'm going to do is just briefly go over the principles I've already talked about.
Can I do one quick thing that'll enhance all of this? And I played this last hour. I just want to replay. It's only 30 seconds. It's Sebastian Gorka and his anti-Russia, hate Russia doctrine that Trump just appointed him to push. Trump knows exactly what the guy is all about. He's not the only one. Waltz is another one. Now listen to this. Listen to Gorka. This is you might as well say this is Donald Trump's man laying it out, telling us exactly what we can expect. This is it. So listen.
Jim Gorka.
I'll give one tip away that the president has mentioned. He will say to that murderous former KGB colonel, that thug who runs the Russian Federation, you will negotiate now, or the aid that we have given to Ukraine thus far will look like peanuts. That's how he will force those gentlemen to come to an arrangement that stops the bloodshed.
Got it? So Donald Trump is going to pick up the phone and threaten Vladimir Putin into solving the war? Oh, no. No, 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 no.
You know what?
Anyhow.
This is the old neo. This is the same neocon stuff that we have right now. This is Mike Pompeo. This is Joe Biden.
It is.
This
is
everybody that has been in there for the past 4 years. This is the neocons. This is the warmongers. But you have to remember, he's just a counterterrorism expert. Okay? So the person that has his ear, okay, will be Tulsi Gabbard, okay, as Director of National Intelligence. All right.
Most importantly,
so
he's out right
job.
Now speaking on national media for Donald Trump. That's what you just heard. This is after he was appointed.
I know, but it's the same. It's the same crap. It's you know. Listen, when I saw the reviews, the reviews on like what Mike Waltz said and what General Jack Keane says, you can just look at all the comments. People are saying these are liars. These people are full of shit. This is what the people are saying. About these people. This is what the people are saying about Gorka. Okay, don't you think Donald Trump is going to pick that up? And, you know, that's what Director of National Intelligence is. They can put their thumb on what people think. He's going to know that the American people don't buy that shit. We voted him in to stop the war. He's got to stop it. The person who can give him the information, the correct information to stop it, is Tulsi Gabbard. She knows what will stop it. She can give him that solid advice. And if he wants to really, he's going to be pressured to perform. So if he wants to actually stop it, he needs to listen to her. And she will tell him how to stop it. See what Sebastian Gorka said? That's the same thing that Mike Pompeo said. He said, we're going to give them $10 trillion and force them to come to the table. Yeah, that's not what Trump's going to do.
Well, it's
that's
just like lining up with Jake Sullivan saying we're out of the same cage. We're going to nothing going to happen.
No,
it's different. We're not going to let our friends down in Ukraine. No.
Anyway, and listen to this. So you know who else understands these principles of war? The Russian army. They know these principles of war. They meditate upon these. Okay.
Yeah.
So let me review what I've already talked to you about. Just a brief sentence.
Before we start, let's mention Mitch's book,
okay.
The Final Wars. Yes. Sorry for the interruption. I want all of you to put this on your list. For what a Christmas gift for yourself. If you want to, I'm going to call this a Bible. It might as well be, of survival and how to get through the tough times that obviously are coming here. You need this book. You've heard Mitch for years on the program. The best of the best is all in this book. It is a Bible of survival. That's what it is. The Final Wars, Amazon. That's all you have to remember. Go to Amazon, get this book, The Final Wars by Mitchell Henderson.
It may be under Mitchell. You might have to look under Mitchell Henderson. Sometimes if you type in The Final Wars, it comes out. Sometimes you got to add Mitchell Henderson to do it.
Okay, very good. So, all right, go ahead, Mitch.
And these books, my book, has all these principles of war spelled out in it. So
they're
it's
all there.
In the book. So the first one is objective. The purpose of war is to destroy your enemy, to destroy their ability and will to fight. Keep in mind, Putin understands this and we don't. Russia will destroy their enemy, and they will destroy our ability and will to fight. They can do that. They have the nuclear weapons to accomplish that, okay? We don't think that way, but they do. The second principle is offensive. You must seize and maintain the initiative in a war. That means you're the one who needs to act first. Beware, people. Putin is aware of this, too. He knows he has to act first. If he goes nuclear, he's got to act first, okay? He's got to just pull the trigger and let it go. Okay, it's not that he's going to use all his weapons. Nobody would do that, but he's going to use enough of them to destroy us and make us not a threat to him. Because the person who takes the initiative is likely to win the war. Okay, and that's the offensive. In other words, the best defense is a good offense. Right? I know you've heard that before.
Oh yeah.
The next principle is mass. You must apply massive force and violence of action, at the decisive place and time. Think about nuclear war. What does that mean, massive force and violence of action? That doesn't mean a few demonstrations. That means to shoot the wad, okay? To just, blam, let it go. And this is, Putin knows this in his head, okay? Maneuver is the next one. Knock the enemy off balance and keep him off balance. Place the enemy in a disadvantageous position and keep him there. So it's like once you take the initiative and knock them off balance, you have to maintain the initiative at all times to keep them off balance. Okay, in military time,
sure.
As just an infantryman or an armored cavalry officer, it's like one of the things that was an imperative that I do is once I made contact with the enemy, I had to do everything I could to maintain contact with the enemy. You don't like hit the enemy and then let them run away. You keep on them. You keep on the enemy. Okay, that's how you keep them off balance. Okay,
got it.
So the next principle of war was security. Never let the enemy have the advantage. Don't get caught by surprise in the wrong place or wrong time. It's sort of the opposite of maneuver. You must choose the time and place of battle. Keep this in mind. This is not something that any American general knows. This is not anything that the President Trump thinks. This is nothing that our national security advisors think. But this is what the Russian army thinks. You must choose the time and place of battle, not your enemy. You have to choose it. Okay. And keep in mind too that this is even for a fist fight. You have to do this too. You got to pick the time and place of battle. Don't let them throw the first punch. Okay. So you know who knows how to fight? The Russian army knows how to fight. These principles of war were wiped out in the 1990s. They didn't teach them to the American army anymore. Okay.
Look how combat hardened they are. How seasoned they are under high stress.
Yeah.
They've been fighting now for over 1,000 days to clear Donbass of Ukrainian army. They still haven't gotten them all out of there. And then Ukraine, of course, invaded Russia, physically invaded Russia into the Kursk area, and they're still there. They've lost about 40% of what they initially had alleged control over, but they're not going to hold on to it, obviously. They're being ground up.
No,
you know, they've lost 40,000 dead in the Kursk salient already.
Yeah.
40,000 dead that Zelensky has just burned up. You don't care about human life.
Now, did you see that tape that I sent you, that YouTube thing about where Fox News is asking this woman who's a strategic advisor and stuff? The Fox News guy says to her. She says, well, we all know that the Russian army is decimated and they're wiped out. And this woman, I just loved it. She said, I beg to differ. She says, the Russian army is in a better position than they've ever been in. She says, they are not worn down. They are not decimated. They are at the top of their game. She said, my job is to go tell people the truth. My job is not to tell them what they want to hear. I tell them the truth. She said, I go to top secret briefings, and I tell them this truth. Okay? So you know everybody knows the truth, but they're not listening to her. They want to believe their own delusions about, America is the most powerful military in the world, blah, 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 and our technology is the best.
This is an interview on Fox?
Yeah. I sent you an email. I think I sent you a...
I'm looking for it right now. I'm looking.
Okay, if you don't find it, I can send it to you again later.
All right, let me look. Go ahead.
Yeah, so,
Russia, by the way, not just in terms of military strategy, combat hardened, combat aware, their tech is incredible. This new missile they have is, we're trying to build it too, but we're a couple of years away. There's a lot to be said about this missile. It's quite a deal. Anyway, go ahead and we'll carry on.
So the next principle of war that I'm going to cover is surprise. So you want to hit the enemy where and when he is not prepared. Okay. So this is an offensive principle, but there may be occasions or you will have to attack. The Hmong and Laos made an art out of booby trapping. They understood the psychology of surprise. They would place a booby trap at the that the Phuket Lao would walk into. But what was important is where to put the next one. They said after they trigger one booby trap, the Phuket Lao will be hyper-alert looking for the next one, at least for a while. As they march on for hours and hours without encountering another booby trap, they become complacent and are paying less attention. This is where you place the next booby trap, okay? So think about these wars in Israel. Think about the war in Ukraine. This is what you see going on. They do something, and then everything calms down for a while. Then they do something else, and that's what keeps everybody riled up, okay? So it's an old technique, okay? So, I mean, when I first went to Asia, I thought that, you want to put booby traps everywhere and stuff. But the Hmong, they taught me otherwise. They said, well, for them, landmines were kind of expensive, so they booby traps were kind of hard to make. Not very difficult, but it took a little time to make a nice booby trap. So they didn't just throw them about. They put it where they wanted you to walk into it. They didn't want you to discover it and dismantle it. They wanted you to walk into it. And the way you do that is by, after one goes off, you have to give them time to drop their guard again before you place the next one. Okay? It's just human nature that they're taking advantage of. So, I met three serial killers while working in law enforcement. They use surprise. They cultivate complacency.
I met three. That's quite a few. Or are there that many out there?
there's lots out there. You've probably met some and don't know it. So they cultivate complacency or use ruses like the hooker or pusher who is going to lure you into a vulnerable position to rob you. The first one was Bobby Joe Long. Many of the vice prosecution cops were seconded to homicide division since Long was preying upon street hookers. We got this idea to try and get the hookers to take tag numbers of Johns that picked up their girlfriends. The hookers balked, saying that they were not going to give the cops tag numbers of their tricks. We said that we did not want all the tag numbers, only the tag numbers of cars that picked up girls that they did not see again. That did not work because Long would find isolated hookers that were working alone. The hookers told me that they would not get in a car with a creepy guy. Long.
Whoop. Did we lose Mitch? Okay. We did. Keep your eye on this new Russian missile. It has allegedly really shaken up Zelensky, and also the Biden administration. This missile is deadly, and it came down. I'm still not sure if it's a traditional explosive warhead or kinetic warhead. I'm still looking for more information. Go ahead, Mitch. You're back.
Okay. So I don't know where I got cut out at. I think I was talking about Bobby Joe Long would pick up isolated hookers that were working alone.
That's right.
Hookers told me that they would not get into a car with a creepy guy. Long was not a creepy guy. He was mild-mannered and polite. I told the hookers that the killer was not a creepy guy, that they would probably like him and feel comfortable with him. That is why he gets his victim, by giving them a false sense of security. Hookers are prepared for rough trade. They carry razors, knives, and knife sticks. They end up dead because the serial killer does not signal any evil intent. He gives the hooker the sense that they are in control. Everything is just fine. Then the mild-mannered Dr. Jekyll transforms instantaneously into Mr. Hyde by blitzing them out of the blue. Even though they knew that a serial killer was coming hunting for them, they were still caught by surprise. Okay. Go ahead.
No, I'm just always saddened when I think about how ill-prepared most people, especially young women, are in a very violent and evil world. As a police officer, you knew all this. Whose fault is this? The schools? The parents? All the above? The media? It's not all champagne and roses out there, ladies. You've got. I don't care how old you are, you've got to be careful. All the time, now more than ever. And if you have children, never let that child out of your reach. In fact, I would, if I was out with a child, I would hold his hand or pick him or her up and carry them. I wouldn't let him run around loose. No, a car can come up next to a curb and that kid is gone in a second. Yeah, child.
Let me tell you what's coming across that border right now. Yeah. If you think America has a lot of serial killers, no. A normal serial killer in a country like Colombia or Venezuela usually kills over 100 women before he gets caught because they don't have the techniques and the good
100?
Police work. Yeah. And those people, how many of those people came up here?
Oh.
How many serial killers crossed that border?
I
bet
God only
thousands,
knows.
Thousands yeah. did. Thousands.
I bet you're right.
Okay.
I bet you're right.
So the second one was Eileen Wuornos. While working organized crime, I had to go to the jail to interview a prisoner. I was driving an old pickup truck. I saw Eileen with her girlfriend hitchhiking. They were hitching on the road that goes to the jail, so I thought I could make a prostitution case on the way to jail and just drop them off at booking. Eileen was not like was portrayed in the movie Monster with Charlize Theron. She was friendly, bubbly, and had a sense of humor. Even though she was a street hooker, she had an entertaining and fun personality. That comes from confidence. She knew that she was the dangerous one, not the John who picked her up. After all, what are the odds that there would be two serial killers in the same car at the same time, right? So this is we gave Eileen confidence. She was the serial killer, and she knew it. Eileen asked me my name. That's a good move because she is going to personalize me to get my guard down. I told her, then she playfully said, I am Whore Dog and this is Slut Puppy. She used humor to let me know that they are about sex, but not in a way that creates any stress.
And you had these two in your truck, Mitch?
Yes, they're in my car. Yes.
Okay.
So she wants you to relax. Then she made some more small talk to keep it light. Then she gave the pitch. If you drive us to Orlando, we know a place in the countryside that we can stop and all three of us can have a sex party. This was her MO. She got you to go into the wild someplace and then kill you. So prostitution is defined as offering sex for money or other consideration. The act had to be done within the city limits for the law to apply. And they were talking about the next county over where I did not have jurisdiction. I also had to get to the jail to interview the prisoner. I was only going to make a case if we could have it done by the time I arrived at the jail, only if it was quick and convenient for me. It was just a misdemeanor. I had no idea who she was. So I told them that I had to work, but pointed to the on-ramp for Orlando. They were still cheerful when I turned them down. Most hookers would have bitched at me and gotten into a nasty disposition. Eileen did not. Like Bobby Joe Long, she compartmentalized her Jekyll and Hyde, and she did not let Mrs. Hyde out until you were naked and disarmed. She lulled her victims into complacency with her warm, fun, and unrelenting, unthreatening personality.
Wow.
Once you had your pants down and could not defend yourself, she attacked quickly and without hesitation or mercy. You would not see it coming. She killed at least seven men this way, often getting them to take her off the highway to some secluded countryside place.
Dumb. Gosh, people are dumb.
Ugh. Yeah. The third serial killer was Oba Chandler. He worked with U.S. Customs as a snitch. I socialized with him. Me and other agents had drinks at his house. He did the same thing. He was an ultra-nice guy who you could relax around. There was nothing creepy about him. He did not give off bad vibes. Women were attracted to him. When we went out to a bar, the woman would gravitate to him. He came off as very friendly and fun guy. He used flash to attract the women. He acted like he had money and had status. He knew how to pick up girls. He lulled women into a false sense of security. He invited them out on his boat. Then he would turn the scene into something from hell with torture and rape. He bound them, tied a cement block to them, and drowned them alive. He wanted them to be terrified. Okay, there was a mother and two daughters that came down from Ohio, and he offered to take them out on his boat. He raped and murdered them, and that's how he got caught. Okay, he actually lived behind my parents' house in Tampa, Florida, across the canal. He was a neighbor.
Okay. You know, I've heard, Mitch, if I might, that most serial killers, you'd never guess if you met them.
Oh, no,
you just wouldn't.
No. That's why I say you've probably met. I bet, you know, if you're 30 years old, you've met at least one serial killer. If you're 50, you've probably met three or four serial killers in your life. Well, but you just don't know because they haven't been caught. And for every serial killer that gets caught, there's probably 100 out there that have not been caught. Okay, and the police do not tell you all the women that get picked up and murdered and disappear and nobody ever knows from. That's never published or collated because catching these people is a lot of work and they just don't have the money or the time to do it. Okay, so remember, law enforcement is about giving the appearance of law and order, the appearance of security, because the appearance is doable with a budget. But actual security and actual law enforcement and actual justice is too expensive. And trust me, they're not doing it now. They weren't doing it 40 years ago. Okay. So to continue, all three serial killers that I met used surprise to overcome their victims. If you met them, you would find them to be harmless and likable people. This is how they can kill many people. If they were scary looking people, they would not have many victims. I mean, we watch a lot of slasher movies and scary movies, and the serial killer is always a creepy, guy and stuff like this.
Yeah, that's a Hollywood template.
And that's not what they are. You know, I've met three. They did not come off as creepy to me at all. Okay.
And so, you probably met others that were never caught, so you didn't know.
People. Yeah.
I get it.
So personally, I found the serial killers to be more likable than normal people. They have people skills because they are hunters. Uh-huh. They are predators.
Gotcha.
Okay, it's important for them to have people skills. So Hollywood always portrays them as very creepy people who cannot relate to other people. I would suggest that if you feel super comfortable with a stranger, you should be on your guard. Okay. A great example of a surprise attack in war was General MacArthur's landing at Incheon during the Korean War. The communists had pushed Allied forces into a perimeter around the southeast corner of the Korean Peninsula, around the port city of Busan. MacArthur wanted to land at Incheon so he could cut off supplies to the communist forces to the south by an attack in the rear. The port of Incheon has a major tide every day and was a very bad place to attempt an amphibious landing. The North Koreans did not fortify it because it was not a good place for landing. There were other much better places. The attack could be done only by timing it with the tides. This is also what made it impractical. The front was far away from Incheon. The North Koreans were not prepared for landing there. Consequently, there was little resistance to our landing. We hit the North Koreans at a time and a place they were not prepared. That is what surprise is. Okay. So the next principle of war is simplicity. Okay. A simple plan is less likely to go wrong. The more steps you have to take in executing your plan, the more opportunities there are for something to go wrong. In making a raid on the police department, we always did the same thing. You send a team around the back to cut off their escape, your blocking force. Then you raided from the front. The criminals would usually run out the back, and the blocking team would capture them. As my partner made a busy bus in a grocery store parking lot late at night, he would hit the brakes to signal that he had a case. As the pusher walked towards the street, I would just casually walk down the sidewalk towards him, as if I was just another dirtbag. I would not even be paying attention to him. I would close with him casually as he made it to the sidewalk. Then I would jump on him and take him down. These are simple and straightforward methods, very direct with no intermediate steps. In an infantry attack, you always do basically the same thing. You turn your enemy's flank. You have one team lay fire on the enemy position to get him focused on you and keep his head down. A maneuver team then flanks him from the side. The fire team keeps up the suppressive fire until the maneuver team appears on his flank. You keep firing but shift your suppressive fire away from the side that the maneuver team is attacking. Then the maneuver team destroys the enemy. Destroying the enemy is the goal of any attack. You do the same thing in an armor attack. You do the same thing from a squad to a division. The larger the unit, the more control measures you must employ. The control measures are meant to simplify, not to make it more complex. Control measures are simply so each unit knows where the next adjacent unit is and what they are doing. You must have clear, uncomplicated plans and concise orders to ensure a thorough understanding. Everything in war is simple, but the simple things are extremely difficult. Von Clausewitz called this friction in war, where simple tasks become exceedingly difficult to accomplish. It is best to count on the simple things being very hard. I will illustrate simplicity by discussing an operation that failed due to a lack of simplicity. In 1980, the Carter administration launched Operation Eagle Claw to rescue the hostages held in Iran by the Islamic Republic. The plan was to make a staging area in the remote desert about 200 miles south of Tehran in a remote desert. C-130s with troops and C-130s with fuel were to fly to this salt pan and land by one route.
Right.
8 Sea Stallion helicopters would fly by a different route to the same place. The helicopters would refuel and carry the troops to another remote staging area about 50 miles from Tehran called Desert 2. A CIA paramilitary team would drive trucks out to Desert 2, and the troops would use the trucks to make two separate attacks. The Army Rangers would go to attack an abandoned Iranian Air Force base that was 60 miles southwest of Tehran and secure it. The other force of Delta Force troops, along with CIA paramilitaries, would go to Iran. One group would attack the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to retrieve the three hostages kept there and take them to the large stadium in Tehran. The other group would attack the U.S. Embassy, rescue the hostages, and take them to the stadium. Then the helicopters at Desert 2 would pick everyone up at the stadium and transport them to the air base that the Rangers captured. Some C-141 planes would land at this base and transport everyone to Egypt to escape from Iran. C-130 gunships from Desert 1 would give air support for the attack on the embassy. Other Navy and Marine fighters from aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf would also give air support. There were just too many moving parts happening over vast distances.
Right.
The plan involved hubris, mainly in the form of thinking that it would work and not considering an Iranian reaction. First, it was approved because Jimmy Carter needed to save his presidency. The Iran hostage crisis was making him look weak and incompetent before an election. He needed a win. Of course, the American military could do anything. Jimmy Carter, in fact, had hollowed that military out. I want you to know that I was in the active duty Army, regular Army, during Jimmy Carter, and he certainly hollowed it out. No training. Okay. Of course, the American military could do anything, but it couldn't. Okay. I was serving in the Army in those days, and we did zero training because there was no money to train. Second, the military commanders saw it as a glory operation. It had to involve the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force in a joint operation so that all the services would look good and appear needed. Rangers and Delta Force had to prove their mettle along with the CIA. I kind of got the feeling that including everybody was far more important than simplicity. It's sort of a DEI at the time, okay? The more players, the more complex the operation. It did not get past the Desert One phase. Military aircraft crashed into each other, and a busload of Iranians drove up on the airfield. It was chaos from the beginning. Okay, so this is an aphorism. I mean, I was involved in plant. You know, every team leader, squad leader, platoon leader, company commander, you get involved in planning operations, okay? But you always understand one thing. Plan very good. Be very precise. Have good information. Plan well. Prepare well. But realize that the first casualty of the operation will be your plan. Your plan will be the first thing to fail. Just count on it, okay? It's just that if you're organized going in, you'll be able to recover and adapt better than if you're a total cluster. You know, so consider our current military in 2024. Diversity, equity, and inclusion is more important than ability, skill, merit, training, or simplicity. Our military cannot recruit troops because not many young men see it as a serious force. They see DEI promotions and participation trophies for male soldiers in dresses. Awards and promotions are based on identity, not skill or ability. Our military leadership, who were just defeated in a 20-year war in Afghanistan against illiterate goat farmers with no superpower support, think that we can take on the militaries of Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran all at once. It is the same unwarranted hubris of the Carter years. As a matter of fact, Biden is sort of the Jimmy Carter of the 21st century. Okay. So what could possibly be simple about taking on two major and two secondary militaries at the same time? Once again, there are too many moving parts over vast differences.
Got it.
So, okay, so now we're gonna get into where it's really the next principles for war sort of apply more to groups of people than an individual, okay? So the first one is economy of force. Concentrate combat power on the main objective. See, this is what they're trying to do with Israel by dropping Ukraine. This is economy of force. Concentrate combat power on the main objective. Allocate the minimum effective power on secondary efforts. Ukraine is definitely a secondary effort. Okay. This principle of war obviously applies to groups of fighters. Even a singular fighter should not spend energy and resources attacking an objective that is not critical for his survival. A group of fighters should do the same and not spend energy and resources on an objective that is not critical for their survival. You must always keep in mind that your primary objective is survival, and the most effective way to survive is to avoid contact with an enemy. However, if you are being aggressively hunted or pursued, the best course of action may be to destroy your enemy. In the long run, destroying your enemy may be the least expensive alternative in energy and resources. Remember that you are most vulnerable when retreating, and you can never destroy your enemy on the defensive. If you are defending, you have to go on the offensive to win. Winning is the
complete destruction of your enemy. Hold on.
Yes.
You can never destroy your enemy if you're on the defensive. That's an ironclad statement. That's just how it is. You can't. So if you're on the run or in a defensive position, you're not going to win unless you get real lucky.
You're not.
And outflank them somehow. And anyhow.
Very, very rarely will you win anything on the defensive because the objective is to destroy the enemy. You just can't destroy them on the defensive, okay? So obviously if your enemy is too great and too powerful, then the best course of action is to escape him. Escape can be by losing your enemy, or it may be by resources is too much to continue the pursuit. In other words, it's too costly to pursue you. Okay. Economy of force does not mean that you parse your forces in the attack. You will still need massive force, massive action, and violence of action to win. Economy of force is about not wasting resources on secondary goals. For example, if you have to flee an overwhelming force, your main objective is to escape. Your secondary effort is creating obstacles raid his force and setting ambushes to slow him down and deplete his resources. These secondary or efforts can continue. The main goal contribute to the main goal of escape by making the pursuit of you too expensive and to encourage the enemy to halt his pursuit. Let me give you an example from police work. If the main objective is to reduce crime in the city, you could put a lot of police officers on surveillance at the place and time where the most buggings are occurring. This takes an immense amount of manpower and will leave other areas more vulnerable to criminal attack. Or you could form an anti-mugging squad with just 10 men and set out mugging decoys so that the criminals will come to you. I used to do this in Tampa, Florida, back in the early 1980s. We would easily get up to 10 separate muggers in one evening. A surveillance stakeout would cost more in time and resources, but never be so productive. The mugging decoy team was an effective economy of force operation. How effective was it? The mugging decoy team would have the backup officers that dressed up like street people slowly filter into the area where the decoy was going to not attract attention. So I was the first officer to show up. I sat down on a bus stop bench across from some Skid Row bars. Soon a big black guy came and sat on the same bench. He figured that I was a predator like him. A wino left one bar and headed for another. It was a Wednesday night, so it was the night most of the winos cashed their social security checks. Criminals are aware of these things. I was just looking at the wino, and this black guy put out his arm to stop me and said, "It's not what it looks like, brother. That guy is obviously a cop, and if you mug him, you will go to prison. Don't fall for it. If it looks too easy, it's a trap. I'm going to go down the road to safer hunting grounds." I told him, thanks for the information, and he headed down the street. In fact, I was the only cop around for miles. The wino was just a regular wino, but he was protected by us even if we were not around. That is economy of force. Okay? Another time, the local LGBT advocacy group had complained to the mayor and city council about some vicious robberies that were occurring in the parking lots of gay bars downtown. The robbers would attack gay men that were sitting in their cars in the parking lot having sex or smoking pot. The robbers would rob the gay men of their valuables, smash up their cars, and severely beat them up. It was extremely violent and resulted in expensive damage. Once again, putting out a stakeout to catch the robbers in action would require lots of men and many hours. It's also not likely to succeed because criminals usually case the area before they do a robbery like this. These were not impulsive crimes. They were not crimes of opportunity. The robbers were organized and did their homework. The lieutenant called me in after report one day and asked me to stop the robberies. Stopping the robberies at the gay bars was a secondary effort, and I was the economy of force. I told the lieutenant that the robbers were unlikely to do any robberies since I was in a marked patrol car in uniform. Criminals tried to avoid committing crimes when the cops are nearby, and there was a half a dozen gay bars that were targeted. He just told me, "You're a cop, figure something out." Well, there was only one way, deprive the robbers of the victims. I began arresting the men in their cars, either for smoking pot or lewd and lascivious acts, by having sex in their car. I did not take them to jail because it was too time-consuming, and I needed to arrest everyone I could. I had to deter people from sitting in their cars. I would write them a notice to appear. They would have to pay a $200 fine, but that was much cheaper than being robbed and beaten. Soon, the bouncers at the bar confronted me. I told them that the only way to stop the robberies was to not have any victims of the cars. The bar managers and bouncers saw the logic and asked how they could help. I told them to warn every customer leaving the bar not to sit in their car because a homophobic cop is on the rampage, and they will be arrested. Getting their cooperation was like getting a couple of dozen more cops on the detail. Within a month, no one sat in their cars. After that, I only needed to swing by occasionally and arrest a few who thought that it had passed. With minimal effort and resources, the robberies ceased. The mayor and city council were happy with the results. It did not cost the police department anything extra. There was no scandal created and nor uproar from the LGBT groups about their constituents being busted by cops in the parking lots. The gay bar owners let them know that it had purpose. In warfare, a good example of economy of force is guerrilla warfare. You attack the enemy with raids and ambushes to wear him down. You avoid pitched battles because you cannot afford to lose men and spend resources. You attack the enemy where he is weak and avoid him where he is strong. Raids both destroy enemy resources and can be a source of supply for you to acquire more resources. Ambushes can bleed the enemy without bleeding your troops. You can also acquire weapons and ammunition from the dead troops. Guerrilla warfare is fighting a superior force on the cheap. The Taliban defeated the biggest, richest, most modern military on Earth in a protracted war over 20 years. They had no real professional soldiers and had no superpower support. They just never quit, no matter what. Economy of force fighters have kept Somalia a failed state since 1992 and has done the same in Libya since 2011. Okay? So in this operation, okay, for the gay bars, okay, there were really two components. One, I was depriving them of their victims, okay. But sure. The other thing that I did is I used the culture and I used the cultural terrain, the human terrain, okay. I appealed to the bouncers at the gay bar and the managers and stuff to assist me. Because they could send the message, don't sit in your car, okay?
Got it.
And achieved the result.
Smart.
And this is what we should have been in a guerrilla war. You do the same thing. You got to go get the cooperation of the local people. But
you don't want to turn the indigenous people.
Will not do that.
No, you don't want to turn the indigenous people against you. You don't.
Right. So Americans go into Afghanistan and says, oh, you got to have women in charge of everything, and you have to let gay people be as gay as they want to do. You got to respect their rights. How are the Afghans ever going to buy that? They're a very traditional Islamic culture. They were never going to buy the woke government that we wanted to impose on them. It was absurd.
Very good. So. Mitchell, thank you. We are over time. That was excellent. And let me ask all of you again, just to put this on your list, Mitch's book, The Final Wars. It's a complete guide to everything in these terribly dark times we live in. Mitchell Henderson, Amazon, The Final Wars. Good one to grab. Thank you, Mitch. Talk to you next week.
You're welcome. And happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Happy
Indeed.
Thanksgiving.
Very good. Thanks, Mitch. You too. Okay, we'll be back with more in just a few minutes. Hold on.